The Mummy is one of the most beloved action-adventure films of all time. Let's do a deep dive on this timeless classic from 1999.
What's up, movie friends? Welcome back to Raiders of the Lost Podcast, the ultimate film and TV podcast. And The Mummy is out in theaters. They did a re-release for the anniversary for the film. And my God, this film is so fun. It holds up. And I have an absolute blast with this film. I haven't seen it for a few years, but I just forgot how timeless it is, how classic it is, and how fun The Mummy is.
It really is. It harkens back to that era of great action adventure films. It's probably the closest thing we've ever gotten to the Indiana Jones franchise, The Mummy, as well as Pirates of the Caribbean. Those two franchises, really the only things that compete with Indiana Jones. This one feels like an old classic adventure film, like those 1950s, 1940s ones, adventures in jungles and stuff like that. But this one really fits the mold of a new era of action, a new era of the adventure film when it came out in 1999. What a year. I mean, we just did The Talented Mr. Ripley last week. That also came out in 1999.
Wow.
The Matrix came out in 1999.
Best year ever.
The greatest year in cinema. We did an episode on it. There's no competition at all. And it was written and directed by Stephen Sommers. Rotten Tomatoes, it's a 61% critic score. Almost rotten over there.
Damn.
Audience score is 75%. IMDb, it's a 7.1. Letterboxd, it is a 3.5. On a budget of $80 million, The Mummy in 1999 grossed $416 million at the global box office for Universal Pictures. This obviously harkens back to The Mummy franchise, the monsterverse of the Universal Pictures in the 20th century, and they tried to obviously reboot this like 7 years ago with Tom Cruise. Didn't work out very well, but this was a huge success at the time of its release in 1999. It had the 9th biggest opening weekend ever at the box office,
damn,
which is just the norm now.
Yeah.
For it's probably like 800th now because the last 10 years have inflated
it's
numbers
not,
so intensely.
It's not even cracked the top 1,000 anymore.
It was a 43 domestic opening, which back then was absolutely massive. It's still big, but it's not as big as we've seen lately.
Yeah. And this movie does a great job of doing a bunch of things. So first of all, it harkens back to the original Mummy film, and we get some great horror and great special effects and visual effects, as well as an interesting story with Imhotep. And then we got so much adventure and mystery and swashbuckling from the Indiana Jones franchise, and it did pretty good with the horror, too. There's, for a PG-13 film, there's some pretty disturbing imagery in this film and disturbing setups. And they did a great job of not showing gore because the filmmakers were forbidden by Universal to show any gore. So in terms of the mummy Imhotep, they did an amazing job crafting a scary-looking villain, a monster, a creature, without putting off the audience and keeping the PG-13 rating. And also, we got a lot of great off-screen violence. Like, one of my favorite shots is one of the guys getting sucked, and we just see his shadow, him getting shrunken and shriveled. I remember as a kid, that was really disturbing and scary to see. And as a child, we saw this like opening weekend. I remember waiting in line in the movie theater at Showcase Cinemas, and I just remember there's a huge line into the theater. This is before like they would open the doors and everybody would run in because they weren't reserved seating. So there was often,
there'd be a line, but
there, for very big movies there would be a line and you'd be waiting inside the actual cinema lobby waiting to get into that theater. I remember standing in the line and seeing the poster of like the mummy in the sand dune, and I was like, oh my God, this is so scary. I'm gonna be so terrified. But it ended up being so much fun and an incredible experience, and this is one of our most beloved films as kids growing up.
I'm personally put off by the mummy. He's disgusting, especially when he eats that scarab beetle in his mouth. I was like, ugh, it irked me, bro. But we're so excited to finally do a full episode on the mummy. We broke it down with a couple other films. We did a National Treasure mummy episode like a year and a half ago, but we're devoting an entire 90-minute episode.
All day.
We'll be here forever talking about The Mummy. And real quick, we just want to promote tomorrow. We're launching an Indiegogo campaign for our latest film. It's going to be called One Click. The crowdfund campaign launches tomorrow on Indiegogo. Check all the socials for links to that to help donate to our film. We're going to do some crazy stuff. We have a pretty big budget, but we're going to do things like blow up a car and do some fun stunts. So that brings the budget up. Plus, it's going to be a SAG production. We're very excited about it.
And if you want to see James riding on top of a car, check out the video tomorrow.
Yeah, the video and
Tuesday.
The links will be there as well. So very excited for you all to see that. Now, let's get into The Mummy. And you know what? For 1999, There's a lot of CGI in this film, specifically in the first act, as well as great production design and practical effects, which I can't wait to discuss as well. But the CGI opening, I don't hate it. It obviously hasn't aged. It hasn't aged fantastic. It looks like a video game. However, I'm fine with it. It looks pretty good.
It looks fine for me. I've went through phases with this film. I think that when we were younger, we loved it. Then in my 20s, I was like, oh, the CGI looks like so bad. Like, oh my God, I can't believe they made this. And then as I got older, I'm like, especially watching it last night, I was like, this movie fucking rocks. And I gave it 4.5 stars on Letterboxd. For the most part, the CGI is very good. The opening, I mean, you got to keep in mind, this is 1999. You know, this is a very long time ago. It does look like a cinematic in a video game, obviously. But for what it is, it does look pretty good, especially scanning it on film and getting that grain in there really helps sell it. I like the opening. It sets up the stage. It's cool to see Egypt, what it was like on a big scale, on a big screen. So in terms of the CGI opening, I think it works. And then it sets up the stage for the grand scale of the scope of the film.
And the visual effects in this film are solid. Like we said, they hold up pretty well. So doesn't The Mummy. I think The Mummy holds up pretty well when he's in his, you know, deteriorated form. He's still gooey, juicy. But juicy and walking around killing people. Pretty solid, as well as some of the effects of the spirits, the souls of, you know, Anux and the Moon coming to cover her body, like that. Or like weird aura, the smoky vapor.
The soul, yeah.
The soul of her. Looks pretty fine. It looks solid. But the special effects in this movie are stellar. Mm-hmm. There is so much going on. So many guns get fired in this movie. So many explosions. So many great stunts. So many gags. We have squibs all over the place. We have so many shootouts. Fire burns left and right. The boat sequence is terrific, as well as when we're at the big city, Amenoptera. Lots of great battles and stunt work and creativity done there as well. But just the practical elements of this film, of the special effects, really make this movie. I think like 6 times I shouted out loud when we were watching this last night. Like, this movie's awesome. The action kicks ass. And it's just, it's not crazy. It's not super complicated. It's pretty simple. It's campy at times. It's sort of tongue in cheek. Like when they're on the boat attack and the bullets are coming through the wall, when it's Evelyn with Rick and the bullet holes are coming through the wall while Rick is reloading his revolver.
They're getting closer and closer. Yeah,
and Evelyn just pulls him away from one of the bullet holes. It's just very fun and camp at the same time as just being terrific on camera. It looks so good.
It's a really hard tone to pull off nowadays, and I enjoyed the action in this film. It is quite epic. I love that opening war scene where you get these 100 horseback riders in the desert charging Amenoptera, and I'm just like, oh my God, this is fucking great. This is all on camera. It looks really fantastic, and some Lord of the Rings style epic scale horse riding right there. And the production design of this film is absolutely stellar. That opening scene of Imhotep trying to resurrect his love, and that interior is just really stunning. And then we'll see more later on in the film, especially the tombs. I think that the team did a fantastic job crafting these environments. It really sells it, and it lets the stunts and the action really take advantage of these huge sets they built, because they have a lot to work with. And the costuming's fantastic. All around, the production is a really terrific film. If it was made today, obviously, visual effects would be much better. But I think that the Imhotep mummy, for the most part, looks amazing. And as a kid, I thought it looked real. You know what I mean? I thought it was like I thought it was photorealistic. And obviously now it's a little dated. But I think that's why some of the CGI in the rest of the film isn't quite up to par, because they really had to put all of their budget into making sure the mummy looked as good as possible, because he's interacting with people in scenes. So for the visual effects, that is really the highlight of the film. For the most part, for an mostly animated character, it's sold the whole time.
I think some of my favorite visual effects shots are when Rick is fighting the mummies in the third act. It's really terrific stuff with the sword and everything. There's a lot going on. We'll get to that later on. But something about this film that I just can't wait to talk about is just the characters and the tone, like you brought up earlier. You know, Rick is this sort of gunslinger outlaw. He's probably former military, but he is also a gunslinger. And this movie has this great tone of ancient culture and then a Western at the same time, and a war film in a lot of ways too. So this tone, like you said, it's almost impossible to capture, but bringing in great comedy, great action, but the characters are what sell this movie so well. Rick O'Connell is a character we all still love, and we fell in love with him. We fell in love with Evelyn so much. We love Rachel Weisz. Brendan Fraser in this film are terrific. The chemistry is off the goddamn charts between these two. Sexual awakening for everybody, I think, watching both Evelyn and Rick on camera together because they are just chef's kiss, perfect specimens. But Brendan Fraser, oh my God,
so
what a golden god. Like when he shows up in this movie, especially after he gets rescued from the imprisonment. And he's like clean shaven, and it's like a great shot of him in the sun.
Evie's
like,
first look at him.
And Evie's just like, oh my God.
Oh shit.
Oh, like, why? Visibly turned on. It's just hysterical. It's true, but
she's so funny.
Yeah, Rachel Weisz is hysterical in this movie. She's perfect as Evelyn. I am a librarian, but these characters we just still think about. And I think that's for me one of the main reasons why I revisit this movie almost annually, and every time I watch it, I enjoy it so much. It's bombastic. It's awesome action. It's a terrific story, but it's these characters that I just really love. Jonathan, Imhotep, everyone's terrific.
Yeah, Ardeth is awesome. And
hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
They're all very distinct from one another, and they all have their own qualities. And it's these archetypes, they work. They really work, and we kind of lose the archetypes nowadays because Hollywood likes to blend them together into one character. They'll give one character all of the great qualities of being highly intelligent and an action hero and have a tragic backstory and be comic relief all in one.
And morally good.
And that, in my opinion, makes it kind of boring with most modern big-budget Hollywood movies where We're losing the distinction between characters, and they're giving everybody, or even just a handful of leads, all of the qualities. Whereas this film, everybody is very distinct from one another. Rick is the swashbuckling hero. Jonathan is the comic relief, kind of a bumbling bozo, but he does get some stuff done. Evie is the brain. She's highly intelligent and has great ingenuity and really helps solve all of the riddles. And then we get the soldier, Ardeth Bay, and then we get a couple of other characters, Imhotep being a great villain. These archetypes, and the reason why the characters work so well in this film is because the archetypes are so well done, and every character is so distinct from one another. Nowadays, it's like everybody is kind of the same, and it kind of takes away from the interesting nature of writing characters, and especially when you have a lot of modern-day leads, they'll have all of the qualities of these five people. And it just takes away from the interesting nature of what the story could be. It saps out of the potential.
Absolutely agree. I think that's so spot on. I mean, Evelyn is such a funny character because she's also a klutz. She knocks over all the shelves in a library. She's super smart. She's also in an era in 1923 when women aren't respected. Even that the Egyptologist says, they're led by a woman. What does a woman know? It's so crazy bad. In that era, she would not be respected. She's just kind of stuck to a library for organizing a library and doing translations. But it's her dream to get out into the field and do things and explore, because that's what her parents did. We get great backstory in all the characters. Evelyn's parents and Jonathan's parents were explorers. They both passed away. Her father was an explorer who married an Egyptian who was also an explorer and adventurer. She sort of wants to live up to the family name in a lot of ways, but she's stuck in this library. But this is her opportunity to do something, to discover something new, to discover the city of the dead, Amenoptera, and do something for real in the field. And she's hysterical because everyone's flawed in this movie. Evelyn is a flawed character despite being insanely charismatic, super funny, and like you said, the brains of the operation this whole movie. But she makes mistakes, hysterical moments of, like I said, knocking over the bookshelves and just sort of being a disaster in terms of knocking things over and stuff like that. But she's very clever. She's sort of like a Hermione character, except funnier.
And the thing is, Evie, in a way, she's a damsel, and that's okay. You know what I mean? She doesn't turn into an action hero, and I think the film, it works for that because not every character has to end up being an action hero. We get that a lot nowadays, but I really like this film because she's a librarian. She's a bookworm. It wouldn't make sense for her to start fighting and shooting guns. You know what I mean?
No sense at all.
She does fire a gun, but it like knocks her down. She's like, it keeps the believability of the world they built.
That would be the Disney version of The Mummy.
So in the Disney version of The Mummy, she would be a librarian and the action hero, and it's just I think this film really works, and people love films like this because when you, like I said, when you give one character all of the qualities, it takes away from it. And so Rick Dalton being the action hero.
Rick O'Connell.
Good picture.
Goddamn hippies.
Rick O'Connell is the action hero. He fights. That's okay for the guy to do that. It's okay for movies like this to exist and to have these archetypes. It doesn't have to be every movie. You can have plenty of movies where you don't have the damsel, and then you have plenty of movies where you do have the damsel. You can have the best of both worlds. And in my opinion, something like this, it really works, and it works for the setting too and the period, and it just makes sense for the world they built. And Evie actually is probably the MVP of the movie, if you think about it.
100%.
She solves all the problems. She's the most intelligent person in the film, and really ends up saving the day. She saves the world. She saves Rick at the end and saves the world.
She saves the entire planet, Evie, yeah. Evelyn.
She's the one who saves everything. So it doesn't always you don't always have to fight to save.
Jonathan's a bumbling idiot. Yeah. He's hysterical, but he can't fight for his life. And even when they're in the standoff with the guns, he's like, and Rick O'Connell's like, I've had worse odds. And Jonathan's like, I've had worse too. And he's like, what?
And Jonathan can't really get much done until Evie's like helping him.
True.
So I think that this film does a great job of, we have a female character from an outside point of view, people who might look at this in a wrong way, they might see, oh, she's just a damsel.
Today's audience.
Yeah. But if you watch the film, she gets captured and imprisoned, but it has to do a lot with the story, with the ritual and sacrifice. And yes, she is saved, but then she saves everyone after that. So they do a great job where, yes, she's a damsel, but she's also the biggest hero of the film at the same time.
Well, let's talk about the story because it's really solid. I think they came up with something very clever and it's just written really well. And so basically, we have this high priestess Imhotep from the past in ancient Egypt. And he is having an affair with the mistress of the pharaoh, who nobody was allowed to touch except for the pharaoh. However, the pharaoh discovers it, and Anuxinamun, the mistress that Imhotep is sleeping with and is in love with, kills
sleeping with.
The two of them murder the pharaoh. Mm-hmm. It's Ramses?
Ramses.
I can't remember. They murder the pharaoh, and then Anuxinamun commits suicide out of love for Imhotep, and also so she doesn't get slain herself. And then,
so she doesn't get mummified.
She doesn't get mummified. And then Imhotep flees and will promise to resurrect Anuxinamun, which he attempts to do. However, he is thwarted by the pharaoh's warriors and bodyguards. He cannot complete the ritual to resurrect Anuxinamun from
the
dead.
Every time.
He's so close.
Twice. He's got the knife.
Anuxinamun's like,
God damn it. Interrupted.
Anuxinamun's like, you're nothing to me but an empty seat.
Just slam the fucking knife down, bro.
And so he can't complete the ritual, so she goes back to the living in the life of the dead, or whatever, the plane of the dead. Wherever she is, chilling, is a ghost.
The underworld. The life of the dead.
I don't know what they call it in ancient Egypt.
The underworld.
Egypt. Is it the underworld?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
It's the underworld. Catch of the Guardians of the Underworld.
You're right.
Horus is like the leader of the underworld.
Yeah. The leader of the underworld?
Yeah.
He's like Prince.
It's like Hades in Greek mythology. He's in charge.
And so he gets a curse put upon him in the worst form of suffering you can get. He gets buried alive, mummified alive in a sarcophagus. Wait, no, he's not mummified. His priests are mummified alive. He's put in a sarcophagus and eaten alive until death slowly by scarab beetles and buried somewhere very secretive under the legs of Anubis. And a curse is put upon him where he will suffer for eternity in the underworld. However, if he is discovered, he will become unstoppable and have unlimited power and bring the 10 plagues back to Egypt. Cut to present day, 1923, where Evelyn seeks to find Hymenoptera after her brother Jonathan discovers a little key device from a dig, which he actually took from Rick O'Connell, who was at Hymenoptera in a battle.
Nice setup.
And becomes their lead.
Do you want to tell the whole movie?
He becomes their lead and their guide to Hymenoptera. That's the plot.
It's a great setup. And I'm on board, man.
Then the mummy gets set loose.
I'm on board, bro. I am on board. Let's go.
But then what's so great about this new movie is secret cities. And I love, like, buried treasure. Mm-hmm. Atlantis has always been fascinating to me. A secret city that could have existed. Maybe hasn't existed. Maybe it did. It's a myth. Hymenoptera is sort of that. It's a myth of a city. It's a tale told to tourists in Egypt. Did it exist? No one really knows. Some people claim they've been there. Rick has been there. And now Evelyn, after discovering the map inside that key, wants to go to Hymenoptera.
They actually threw in the Prince of Egypt storyline, the Bible storyline of the plagues of Egypt as well.
Yeah.
They threw a bunch of things together, and it actually works. It actually worked really well.
I think
the
plagues are a lot of fun.
The plagues are great. When you were a kid, did you think Scarabeetles, murderous, carnivorous Scarabeetles are real?
Absolutely. I thought they existed.
I thought they were real, too. I was like, oh, my God, I don't want to go to Egypt if those are around.
Or at least they existed in ancient times.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, I thought they were real things. And the Scarabeetles are one of the best parts of the film. And then the visual effects of, like, a Scarabeetle under the skin is actually really good for the time, for 1999. And as a kid, those are some the most, like, spine-tingling scenes in this movie of the skin being, you can see the beetle under the skin moving and crawling across the body and into the guy's skull and eyeball, eye socket, and then with Jonathan later on. But I always, and they did, I think they understood the audiences really liked the Scarabeetles, because in the second film, they really doubled down on Scarabeetles. And we saw them a lot in that film. But they did a great job. The CGI looks really good for the time. And the Scarabeetles are one of my favorite parts of this movie.
Yeah, me too. And what's great is, like you were talking about the gore, I can't really think of much blood in this movie at
all. Zero blood.
I don't think there's a single drop of blood.
There's a little bit of blood, and it's just
part.
It's just after someone, I think someone gets stabbed or something, there's just like a couple of drops of blood. It's not splattered. There's a couple, a little bit of blood on someone's shoulder, and that's it. That's the rule for PG-13, especially in 1999, no blood at all. So especially like think about when Rick stabs Imhotep at the end in the gut when he's now mortal. There's no blood, and he actually has to cover the wound with his hands. Yeah. That was because of the studio was like, don't show that wound.
They'd be pouring blood.
That's why Imhotep's like covering it as he walks back into that pool. So the rule for the whole film is we can't show any blood whatsoever, especially not splatter, and there's no wounds at all. And so that's how they're able to maintain the PG-13 rating, even with Imhotep killing his victims, sucking them dry, and then also he sucks them dry, man. Gets all that juice out. And then when he's in zombie mummy form, basically, there's no blood. It's all very one-tone color. If you look at it, it's just beige, sand-colored flesh. And it's not doing much color, not doing any blood. Even when he's regenerating, it would make sense that you see the juices flowing and stuff. And seeing more, you see the blood or whatever, you see the internal organs. That realistically, it would have worked better if they showed all that stuff, muscle tissue. But they had to maintain the PG-13 rating. So that's why Imhotep has this like brown, sand-colored tone for all of his flesh.
Yeah, and he has no organs. They strip the organs out purposely for that reason. And it's just interesting because this movie is still effective and gets that effect of seeing gore. Like you brought up earlier how they sort of do stuff and cut sort of off camera. There's a shot you were talking about.
The shadow.
The shadow of the guy being just turned into a raisin, basically.
Yeah.
And then we have the shots of when his priests are being mummified alive. Someone has prongs on some guy's tongue, and then a knife is being slowly pushed down onto it. But then someone just steps in front of frame and blocks it. But still, in your mind, you're like, oh, my God, he's getting his tongue cut off. And then some of just the physical performances of those guys getting mummified alive, they're like shaking in pain from things. But there's no blood. We're not seeing anyone getting mummified, actually. They're just actors just shaking around and making it look like it's happening. But that just brings that gore to me internally, especially when I was a kid, but even as an adult, when I watched this last night, I was like, oh, that's fucking gross.
Yeah, they're
they didn't show anything.
They're constantly skirting the line, and they're constantly balancing, like, they're pushing it as far to the line as they can go.
And it's funny because the rating system's so silly, the MPAA for in America, because we have maybe 100 people get shot and killed in this movie, and blown up on fire. That's all fine, but the second you start showing blood, they're like, oh, wait.
They're not ready for this, guys.
Do not show any blood. You can pump 18 rounds into a guy with a machine gun, but no blood.
You can show a guy who gets his juices sucked out and he becomes a shriveled human being. That's fine. You show a little blood, you're out, man. Get the fuck out of here.
You know my favorite part about the great prosthetic and like little figures, the prosthetic work of those dummies, the dead bodies after they've been sucked dry, is obviously, they look terrific, but the teeth are perfectly white and intact, which I think is just a great little, a great production design or a great makeup design.
Yeah, because I think
wouldn't be discolored or anything.
Exactly. They'd still be white. So that's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
I thought it looked great.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Thanks.
I thought it looked great too. And the opening is just really fun. Rick's opening after the Egypt opening. And we get the great action scene. Hundreds of horses, we get some great gunfire, a ton of great stunts in this film, lots of horse falls and great, great pyrotechnics.
There's like 200 very good stunts in this movie.
Yeah, it's a really impressive film for stunt work. And like you said, the fire burns when the plague of the the fire comets are hitting down, raining on Egypt. They're just like shooting guys with huge gulfs of flames. It's crazy.
Plus, there's one guy who does a fire burn, then goes through a wall and starts attacking Jonathan while on fire. It's excellent.
After he accidentally pushed him into the burning couch.
Yeah.
This movie's so funny.
It really
this
is.
This movie is so funny.
It's hysterical.
It's a hilarious movie. I was cracking up so much last night. Oh,
Jonathan
my God.
Is so funny. But so is
Benji's funny.
Benji's funny. Evelyn's funny. Everyone's hysterical in this movie, but it's just done so well. And we don't get comedy like this anymore, especially in big action movies. Obviously, it's just now the one-liners, the quips. But this is just great slapstick humor at times, or just great sarcasm. And it's just clever, and characters aren't afraid to look silly when they're doing something.
I love when they're riding on camelback, traveling through the desert, and Jonathan's making – he's like – disgusted by camels, like, look at them, they stink, they spit, and it cuts to the other guy and he's spitting.
Stinky man.
Oh my God, it's so funny.
And like, one of my favorite beats of this whole movie, it's hysterical, it's when Rick throws a chair at Benji, and I'm just like, Benny.
Yes, yeah.
Why do we keep saying Benji? Benny. And he throws a chair at him, it's so goddamn funny,
it's
just
great.
Tosses a chair at him.
Whips it right at him, it's so funny. And I think that the opening is a really great setup for Rick. He's very capable, he's an action hero. But he's not perfect. And then Benji as well. So these are two very important characters. Benji, we learn, is a coward.
Benny,
sorry. Why am I saying Benji?
You made me start saying Benji. It's just Benny.
So Benji.
Oh, my God. Benny.
Benny's a coward. He will save his own skin any chance he gets. He's not loyal. And that ends up being one of the driving forces of conflict for the story when he starts helping Imhotep. And so we have great character setups for these two very important roles in the film. Great action scene. And then we also get a sense for the mystery and the horror happening in Amunatra when Rick is cornered, guns are pointed at him, but then the soldiers are frightened by the cursed city, which is revealing itself. They run away. And then we get that great shot of the sand bursting around him. It's sand flying everywhere. Rick jumps back and he sees the face pouring out of the sand, and then he runs off. That's a great moment for the film. To really showcase this curse is really alive and it's happening.
There's evil there.
Evil here.
And I also love the prison sequence where Rick's in prison. He's been there for a while, clearly. His hair's grown down to his shoulders. He's probably been there for like a year-ish. Mm-hmm. Still looks great, though. Still looks strong as a bull. But in the sequence where he's getting hanged and Evelyn is trying to bargain for his life so that he can guide them to Hamunaptra, Brendan Fraser actually became unconscious and had to be resuscitated because he did it for real. He really did that gag, that stunt.
The drop.
Being hung and then falling through the floorboards. It looked awesome, but he had to be resuscitated. He almost died on set, which is absolutely bonkers.
He dropped like 7 feet.
Easily.
Yeah, it was a hard drop.
Obviously not with his
strapped
neck,
into his
but
chest,
like,
yeah.
I'm not sure how they did the rig, probably some sort of jerk vest or something as he dropped down with a cable, but it looked terrific.
Yeah.
He really sold the hell out of that. And he does a lot of great stunt work in this film. You can pick up on when stunt guys are in there, which is a lot of the sequences. But I think Brendan Fraser did a great job with his stunt work and his athleticism in this movie. And the second film, I feel like he does even more of his own stunts. This one, there's quite a bit going on. He looks great with the gun in his hand, with revolvers. And he's just an action star. You know, he was in George of the Jungle before this. That's really what got him this role, is because of the success of that film.
I thought you were going to say the sex of that film.
The success of that film. This movie was offered to actors like Tom Cruise, Ben Affleck, but a lot of them were either uninterested at the time or couldn't do it because of scheduling. But I think that Brendan Fraser was the perfect choice for this role. And obviously the Brendan Fraser Renaissance.
He's okay, guys.
Renaissance has
Slow
been
down.
So exciting the last 5 years.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely crazy that he almost died during that sequence.
Some actors are just perfectly suited to certain movies, and it's kind of just like a match made in heaven. And plenty of actors could have pulled off Rick, but he really added a great sense of comedy to the role. And he's just got that comedic timing, he's got that comedic presence and good humor, and he made Rick not just a one-dimensional action hero, but kind of a goofy guy at times and just a fun guy to be around. So he had that charm that I'm sure plenty of other leading men in Hollywood couldn't have brought to the role.
Sort of that Errol Flynn classic, don't take yourself too seriously character actor, you know what I mean? I think he fits that mold super well, has fun with himself, and he's just a blast for the audience. You know, he's so entertaining, not just with the action, but with his conversations with Jonathan, his conversations with Benny, with Evelyn, even does cute things with Evelyn because he clearly, he's a tough guy, macho guy, he can't show his feelings too often, but he kind of does when he brings Evie the toolkit, the digging kit. He's like very nervous. It's really funny. You never see Rick like that at all. And then he looks at one of the guys, what are you looking at? What are you looking at? As he's walking away. So he's got a heart at the same time.
Hey, those
time.
Are my supplies. No, they're not.
Like deep down, he does have a heart and he cares for Evelyn. And by the end of the film, you know, they're very much smitten with each other.
Oh, yeah. They're making out, man.
Right, I love the ending
right
shot.
Right next to her brother.
The ending shot's great. Yeah. Last Crusade. Boom. Easy peasy.
And Evie's opening is one of my favorite scenes of the whole film when she knocks all the bookcases over.
T.
I'm going to put you back where you belong. It's a really great stunt. And they did the entire bookcase collapse around the room in one take. None of this was just... They were only going to try it for one take. And if they got it, they got it. And if they didn't get it, they were going to have to spend an entire day rebuilding the set. So it was all done for real. And it really works. And what's great about it is all the bookcases start collapsing in a row like dominoes. And the camera pans with them. That, first of all, is just hilarious, watching each one slam into the other, slam into the other, slam into the other. The camera continues panning around the room in the circle, and then they finally end, the final bookcase falls, and then Evie pops up with her head, and she's like, oh, God. It's a great moment of comedy. That's an example of great comedy just done with cinematography and a performance, and that's it.
Yeah, a great one take. We see the stunt actress on the ladder who actually initiates the first bookshelf to fall, the bottom right corner of the frame. She gets out of the shot as we're panning back. Then obviously Rachel Weisz comes into shot underneath and comes up into the frame. It's just executed so well.
Perfectly timed. It's such a... And her rising into frame, that's the joke. And she's just got her glasses and they're crooked. And she's like, oh my God.
It is so, so funny.
Give me... Locusts! The plagues were nothing compared to you!
Absolutely love that part. It's so, so funny. But then we meet Jonathan in that sequence as well. He's hiding inside of a sarcophagus with an actual mummy. And we get great characterizations right away from both of them.
Yeah.
They talk about their parents and we learn about their past. And
they do a great job with the script of, with just a couple of lines of dialogue, we know who these characters are. Because this guy, the head of the library, I have his character right here, Dr. Terrence Bay. He's like, why do I even have you here? And she's like, I'm the only one who can catalog this library. I'm an expert on Egypt ruins and blah, 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 blah. We know who she is now. Just with her being klutzy, knocking that over, but also being extremely intelligent and inquisitive.
And then he says, no, I keep you around because your parents are one of my best patrons.
Yeah.
So her parents...
They grew up well off, for sure.
They grew up... Well, obviously, they're British, British accents, and probably educated really well, but their parents were well known to the Egyptology community.
And then Jonathan, in contrast, also loves Egypt, but he's not quite as intelligent as her, but he does work in archaeology and works on digs, and he has like kind of like a gray moral area. You know, the key he shows her, he lies to her, says, I found it on a dig, but he actually stole it from someone. So he has kind of like a little bit more of a bad boy. No, I wouldn't call him a bad boy, but she would never steal, but he would.
Yeah.
So we get great differences between the siblings.
He's also educated. He has a passion for Egypt, but his passion is more about getting rich.
Exactly, yes.
And he likes to have a good time. He likes to drink. He likes to have fun. But he's a bumbling idiot at the same time. He knows his history. You know, he has great lines in this movie about, like, it sounds like he's quoting books directly, you know what I mean, about the plagues. Every time a plague comes, it cuts to Jonathan, and the waters and rivers would run red with blood.
Yeah.
You know, he quotes something every time.
But it's great. The siblings are very different. They have the same passion but different motivations. She loves history, and he loves treasure.
Everybody loves something in this movie. I wonder what do you think Rick loves?
Rick loves
adventure.
Yeah, he just loves adventure.
He loves adventure, and you know, he's someone
for me,
that's
the action is the juice.
Yeah.
The Heat reference.
Sick reference, bro. Your references are out of control, everybody knows it.
He's an adventurer.
He's an adventurer and a warrior in a lot of ways. Alright, how about we run to our intermission? We'll be back in just a little bit to talk more about the mummy, but we'll have some fun with some trivia stuff during our intermission. But before we continue, the best way to support Raiders of the Lost Podcast is to become a patron at patreon.com/Raiders of the Lost Podcast. Why would you want to subscribe to Patreon for Raiders of the Lost Podcast? Well, you would get ad-free versions of every single episode. A lot of you understand that we have to put commercials on our show in order to pay the bills and do this full-time. Patreon is one of the main reasons we can do the show full-time. So to thank them, and all of our patrons. You get access to ad-free versions of every episode. You get bonus episodes every single week. You also get access to our Discord, video messages. You can join us for watch parties, which you do every month. We're going to do one, I think, next week.
Oh, yeah.
Which we're very excited about. Or this week, actually.
This week.
This week, we're going to do a watch party. So if you sign up on Discord, you can watch with us. And it's just the only way that we can successfully do this show. Patreon is essential to Raiders of Lost Podcast. Thank you to everyone who has signed up or has signed up in the past. You can also support us by leaving those 5-star ratings and reviews on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We love to read them out loud on Apple Podcasts, the written reviews especially. But these ratings help us get seen by new listeners on the platforms. They help us chart better and better every single week, every single month. And at 5,000 Apple ratings, I will be getting a tattoo of Anthony's choice. Hopefully it's not too embarrassing, but we gotta get those ratings up, everybody.
Gotta get those ratings.
You don't have to leave a written review, but just go log into Apple and leave a rating. Ain't that hard. We're almost at 2,000 now.
Getting there.
And also another great way to support the show is just to share us. Word of mouth is the best way for a podcast to grow organically. Share us with your friends, your family, anyone you know who loves The Mummy, which is probably everybody in your life. Send them this episode.
This episode, of course, is sponsored by our friends at MoviePosters.com, the number one place to get your posters online today. Be sure to use our promo code Raiders10 at MoviePosters.com to get 10% off your order right now. MoviePosters.com has a huge selection of pretty much every movie and TV show imaginable in their poster library. They have a bunch of Mummy posters, high quality prints, huge ones, small ones, whatever you want. Get your Mummy posters at MoviePosters.com. Our home and our set are decked out with all these amazing high quality prints. Very affordable prices over at MoviePosters.com, made even more affordable with our coupon code Raiders10. So be sure to use that coupon code at MoviePosters.com to get a gift for the movie lover in your life, to get yourself a bunch of movie posters to deck out your home, and to show your love for film.
I'm also getting a backlit frame and poster.
Oh, yeah.
That's coming in very soon. It's going to look so good on the sets. I'm going to put it behind me. It's a massive 27 by 42 Towers poster.
Double-sided.
Fellowship of the Ring, yeah. Poster. But it's going to be backlit, so it's going to look like a movie theater poster. I'm so excited.
So they have the double-sided, legit movie theater posters. They're double-sided because they're backlit, so it shows the better detail. If it's printed on just on one side, it's not going to look as good with the light behind it. But double-sided prints, they look incredible with light behind them.
Thanks, MoviePosters.com.
Oh, yeah.
All right, let's get into our intermission, Anthony. Are you ready?
Ready.
Guess this ready. Movie quote. So actually, it's... All right, so this is dialogue between two characters from a Mission Impossible film, Anthony.
Okay.
But I want you to guess which Mission Impossible movie it is.
Let's go.
I don't think you can get her to do it. You mean it'll be difficult? Very. Well, this is not Mission Difficult, Mr. Hunt. It's Mission Impossible. Difficult should be a walk in the park for you.
Say it again.
I don't think I can get her to do it. You mean it'll be difficult? Very. Well, this is not Mission Difficult, Mr. Hunt. It's Mission Impossible. Difficult should be a walk in the park for you.
Can I go number 4?
It's Mission Impossible 2.
2?
Mission Impossible 2.
Oh, Dandy Newton.
Yeah.
Shit. That was my first guess.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Oh, you missed it.
All right, here's my quote.
Don't beat yourself up over it, man.
The loudest one in the room is the weakest one in the room.
12 Angry Men. Say it one more time.
The loudest one in the room is the weakest one in the room.
Sounds very familiar, but I don't know.
Get your hands off me. I said, get your hands off me.
Denzel.
Does that help?
American Gangster?
Yes.
Yeah, American Gangster.
Get your hands off me.
All right, guess this movie release year. Van Helsing.
Van Helsing came out in 2004.
Yes.
Yes. Fuck yes.
He did it. Also directed by Steven Sommers.
Oh, really?
Who hasn't made a movie since 2013.
What was it?
I believe his last movie was the
G.I. Joe
film. Let me double check. Or it might have been the one with Anton Yelchin he did.
Oh, the
Odd Thomas.
Odd Thomas, the investigator guy?
Yeah, so that was the last movie he made.
He must be just doing commercials or something now.
I mean, he's probably made plenty of money.
Yeah.
And...
yeah, commercials pay really well. I'm sure he's still doing stuff like that. All right. What year did A Beautiful Mind come out?
2008.
2001.
It's that old?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
This is peak Russell Crowe, man. Back-to-back nominations.
Has peak Russell Crowe ever ended?
Yeah, it's not peak anymore, man.
I don't know.
Last 10 years, not peak.
You're right. It was back-to-back years. That's crazy. All right, Anthony. Let's do a pop quiz question. How old is Rachel Weisz in The Mummy?
Huh. I'm going to go with Rachel Weisz, when she made The Mummy, was 22.
So Rachel Weisz, when she filmed The Mummy, was 28 years old.
Oh, wow.
And when it was released in 1999, she was 29. Birthday's in March. And this movie began filming in May 1998.
Wow. Very cool. She looks great. She looks great.
She does look really great.
All right, how many films? How many Ridley Scott films has Russell Crowe starred in? And can you name them?
Okay. Gladiator.
Yes.
Body of Lies.
Yes.
It's two. American Gangster.
Mm-hmm.
Three. That's it.
Incorrect.
How many?
It's been in five Ridley Scott
movies.
What
are the other two?
Robin Hood.
Oh my God, I forgot about Robin Hood.
And A Good Year.
They must be really good friends.
Oh yeah, they're pals, yeah. Yeah, Good Year is actually, it's actually a really nice rom-com. Russell Crowe travels to France, where he's inherited an old estate from his uncle. And Marion Cotillard plays his love interest. It's a sweet movie. Very different for what Ridley Scott and Russell Crowe usually do. I like it.
Gotta check it out.
Yeah. It's a cute movie. It's good. Because Marion Cotillard is just awesome.
Yeah. She's terrific.
All right, we got some unsubscribes.
Let's hear these, man, and then we'll get to a great written review.
So for our, if we get 5,000 ratings, James gets a tattoo. Anthony Curran wrote, James is getting an A24 tramp stamp incoming. A24 tramp stamp.
I hope not. That's please, it. Please God, no.
A24 tramp stamp. You're going to look great. And then we have Skylar Lowe on our sci-fi episode. No Independence Day? No Stargate? Unsubscribed. I like Stargate.
Sorry, pal.
It's not up there.
It was the greatest science fiction films of all time.
Yeah, 30 best, yeah.
Yeah, I like Independence Day. It's fun, but it's not for me up there either.
Yeah, it's great, but not quite. All right, Jay Fleming wrote, you definitely said blonde unsubscribed.
Yep, so that was on our Deadpool Wolverine. I thought I said bald woman, referring to Cassandra Nova. But we checked the tapes, I said blonde. I almost said bald, which would have been correct.
You changed it to blonde.
Then Anthony and I got in an argument in a car over whether I said bald or blonde.
I was like, you said blonde. You're like, show me the tape.
And then I showed it up in the car. I literally went, blonde.
The blonde woman. No, I said bald. No, you said blonde. No, I said bald. I said bald.
Embarrassed.
It's so nice to have the actual evidence, the videotape evidence. It's great. I love it.
Anyways, any more?
That's it for unsubscribes today.
All right, we have a terrific 5-star written review on Apple Podcasts.
Oh, let's hear it.
From Steve Januzik, a great friend of the show. Film Boys for Life.
Fuck yeah.
Have you ever wanted to find good movies to watch but don't know where to look? Have you ever wanted to know movie updates and weekly film knowledge but wanted it in one convenient place to get it? Have you had a long day and just want to laugh on your drive to and from work? Well, do I have the best news for you? The Raiders of the Lost podcast is the best podcast out there, created by two great brothers who also just happen to be twins, updating you on great watches of movies you may or may not have heard of, but you'll be glad you did. Or perhaps a movie that's been on your watch list forever and want to watch it ASAP so you can listen to the episode on that very movie.
Oh, thanks, pal.
Learn even more about movies behind the scenes, box office info, different themes of movies, and more to all those only children out there. Yes. This is exactly what it's like to have brothers. James and Anthony really make you feel a part of the family with a warm and inviting podcast. So sit back and give their podcast a listen. You won't regret it. P.S. Subscribe for life.
Thanks, bro.
Steven.
He actually just did that. He watched Talented Mr. Ripley for our episode.
Oh, for the first time?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. I'm so glad he enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Thanks, pal. You are the best. We appreciate you so much.
Thanks, man.
And it's so cool to see you at the New Bev that one night.
Oh, yeah.
That's our written review for this episode.
Great stuff.
What's your streaming recommendation?
John Carpenter's Escape from New York is now on Amazon Prime. Check it out if you haven't seen it. It's a great, fun action movie.
My streaming recommendation is actually connected to Steven, because I think it was like a month ago, I was devastated to find out that the Harry Potter films were off Max and they were on Peacock. But guess what? They're back on Max, baby! The Harry Potter movies are back on Max.
They only lasted 6 months on Peacock.
Woo! Was like,
Warner Brothers was like, give us back the
It was
fucking,
like 2 months, dude.
Give us the golden jewel.
Get it back. So, I mean, that's my streaming recommendation is to watch every single Harry Potter movie at once.
Play them on seven different screens at the same time. Still, it's the only way to do it, man.
I mean, I've never done it, but I'm tempted to.
What would be the last one playing?
The last one playing, which is the longest one? It's probably...
Is it Order? Or is it Goblet?
Goblet might be the longest, or Half-Blood. I think Half-Blood might be the longest, actually.
Longest Harry Potter film.
Because I don't expect it to be one of the Deathly Hallows movies because they're...
Chamber.
Chamber of Secrets is the longest one?
Yeah.
What's its runtime?
2 hours and 40 minutes.
Fuck yeah.
Oh, yeah. It is a long movie.
Hell yeah. I love it.
Doesn't feel like it.
Doesn't feel
like it. It feels like one of the shortest.
Because it's a brilliant movie.
It's your favorite.
I love Chamber. Speaking of Chamber of the Secrets, Chamber of Secrets, though... This movie felt like Chamber of Secrets in a lot of ways with the production design. Now, let's segue back into The Mummy, and the sets are stellar. They're massive. They're not overly complicated, and obviously because it's contemporary 1923 versus ancient Rome for the most part, you don't have to worry about the walls of these ancient ruins, these ancient temples being glittered with jewels and paintings. So there's a lot of sand.
Yeah.
There's a lot of tan colors. It looks like a Dune movie.
It's Dune.
Part one. But it works so well. It visually looks terrific. And even Hamunaptra, just these columns, these destroyed buildings, it's sensational. And the interiors that they're in when they're digging or looking inside the temples and tombs, it just works so well. And the shots are wide, and we can see vast sets. These sets are massive. You know, the Chamber of Secrets set is enormous. It's one of my favorite movie sets of all time.
Yeah.
But I felt like this sort of felt like that in a lot of ways. But these sets are massive. They look like they've gone for hundreds of feet in the distance and to the left and right. And man, they did such a terrific job.
Well, this is like a right before the transition of cinematography and filmmaking, especially with the digital age and now LED lights, which in very sensitive, high dynamic range digital cameras were. Films like this, it feels more like a classic film because when whatever the interior is, we're seeing everything. There's really no deep blacks or dark shadows in this film, even in the tombs. Because with film, they had to make sure they could light everything because film is not as dynamic as digital nowadays, especially. And also the lights back then, there were no cool LEDs which you could perfectly control the color balance of and the strength of the light with luminance with. They were operating with still very comparable gear to movies from the 50s and 60s. And so the sets in this movie, especially the interiors, they remind me of old classical sets where you can see everything's lit up and the entire soundstage, everything, there's no darkness. Nowadays, because of the advancement of technology, filmmakers can portray sets with how they would really look like, whether it be a tomb. They can more accurately shoot the sets of a tomb or the interior of a cave or what have you just with a couple of flames. And the cameras are sensitive enough where they're able to capture the image without showing digital grain. And with this film, with shooting on film, you'd have to use very sensitive stock, which would be very grainy. So it wouldn't look good. So you have to expose the whole image as best you can, which is why scenes like this, when they should be really dark inside the tombs, inside of caverns, everything's lit up. So that's why. But nowadays...
And also because it's not the most artistic film ever because it's, you know, it's an adventure film.
Yeah.
It's for kids, it's for audiences, for young adults and adults, for everyone to enjoy. So they're not being too artistic with lighting.
Yeah. But I do, I mean, obviously nowadays they can be more accurate with what an interior would look like lighting wise. But I do, there's a part of this that this film has this romanticized old Hollywood look to it. You know what I mean? That we don't really get anymore. They would never light scenes like this anymore. But in some ways, I kind of like going back to old films and seeing the sets like that. It's just reminisces on old Hollywood. And something they did a really phenomenal job in this film is there's a lot of fire in this film, not for the stunts, but just for lighting. And there's so many flames on screen in this film. Nowadays, filmmakers would probably stray away from that, but they did a great job of exposing characters and sequences and interiors with a lot of firelight. And then also filling it in with off-camera lights to really help showcase that. But the trick to doing that is, like, if you want the scene to be lit by flames, you show a couple of flames, and then you can use artificial light off-camera to really compound on that warm light. But they did a remarkable job, I think, watching this movie again with the cinematography of showing a lot of actual live fire in sets for lighting.
Yeah, and some of the lighting just doesn't make sense for reality.
Yeah.
For example, when Evelyn's being guarded by two of the cowboys from America that Rick put in charge of not letting anyone inside the door after he puts her in there, she's sleeping and all the lights in the room are on. Yeah. Like, who sleeps with all the lights on? Like a crazy person.
But it's old Hollywood.
Exactly.
It's fine.
That's what a bedroom would be like shot like in the 40s. Exactly. And the thing is, I don't care.
Yeah.
It looks it's fine. It's not what I'm thinking about because I'm having such a good time with this movie. It's just like you're watching, it sort of feels like, especially with the action scenes, like you're at when Universal used to do, which they just stopped doing, the big stunt shows.
Yeah.
Those Indiana Jones stunt shows or stunt shows in general, showcasing what people do on action movies. You know, those movies and those big sound stages that you see as an audience member, which is super fun if you've never done one. We've seen the Indiana Jones one.
That's great.
Sick. It feels like that. So because we're having so much fun, it's no big deal. I mean, Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark, it's just like that as well. We're all on these big interiors and everything's lit pretty well.
Yeah.
And it's fine with me because it's for the audience to have a good time. We're just having fun.
It has, for me, it just has this quality to it with the shooting on film with lots of light. It just feels like it's timeless. You know what I mean?
And the great archetype characters.
Yeah. And they did a really good job with the night photography. There's not that much. They mostly shot in daylight. And they did do a sequence of day for night when the crew is on Camelback and then Rick's the only one awake and he sees the squad in the distance watching them. That's day for night. That looks very good. And then for the most part, the boat scene was shot at nighttime. And then there was another sequence in the campgrounds shot. A couple of those were shot at night. The night photography looks really great. The nice cool blues, the nice moonlight they balanced with firelight with a nice color contrast. So the film looks very good. And I really like the photography of them traveling through the desert. You don't want to do Lawrence of Arabia because you can't. And it's just like, it's a one of a kind. But they did do a lot of great desert photography that suited this film really well.
And there's really not that much green screen. Obviously, the most noticeable green screen shot in this movie is in the opening sequence of back in ancient Egypt with Imhotep on his tower as a priest, and he looks in the distance of the city of Egypt at night. That's clearly green screen, and obviously we can assume some of the sequences, like maybe when they're flying in the plane with all the sandstorm coming after them, probably some of that's got some green screen possibly. But aside from that, there's not much that I picked out and said, oh, that's clearly a green screen shot, because after that first opening, there's not too much CGI besides, I guess, when the mummy's interacting with them, whether it's the mummy he's a body and he's sort of just regenerating and he's at his four different stages of regeneration or five different stages of regeneration as he gets one of the American cowboys who took his canopic jars and opened his cursed box. And then the big sand wall, that's CGI, obviously. And then the mummies in the third act in the temple as everyone's they're all trying to stop Imhotep from succeeding to resurrect Anuxinamun by killing Evie. Those mummies still look pretty solid.
Oh,
but
yeah.
But not really green. There's no green screen, though.
No, that's a great point, because nowadays, in a lot of films, they'll just build some of the set in green screen so much background.
Yeah.
They built all the sets here. Everything was practically done. And so for green screen shots, it's definitely that Imhotep shot in the opening and maybe a couple of others. But otherwise, I couldn't point out any green screen. The only visual effects that was there, like you said, was in camera on the sets and then putting in digital characters after the fact.
Yeah.
And that looks good because the background's real.
Yeah, there's one little sequence where there's definitely some CGI going on. It's as the two different parties after they've left that boat attack, which is such a fun sequence. That set piece of the boat attack is so fun, so well done. And then they're all arriving at Amenatra.
Yeah, I know you're
Anthony knows what I'm going to say. And Benny's crew with the Americans and then Rick with the others, they all meet up at this spot and they're waiting for the sunrise to come up because everyone's like, what are we waiting for? We're waiting to be shown the way. Beautiful shot of the sunrise coming up, which I'm sure was effective with CGI. But then the sky above them in the air, the sky above them is this beautiful blood red sunrise of clouds. And there's no goddamn way they captured that on that day on camera. That's not a real sunrise.
Yeah.
You know, it's beautiful. Well, I've never been to Egypt, so maybe sunrises are red like that, but the odds of having that on that day of filming are impossible. So,
but also with all the coverage they shot, spent 6 hours shooting that.
Yeah, and you can see the ridges of the mountains look like they've been digitally cut out, but like loosely there's some feathering on it. And clearly they got the sky, whether they filmed a different sky and colored it red and put it behind it and superimposed what they shot on top of that. That's my guess. But it looks really cool.
It looks great. I really actually, I noticed that shot too last night. I don't think I had ever noticed it really because I haven't seen this movie in a long time. And like you said, there's a little feathering around Benny's head because they shot it. They did a good job of shooting it, making sure that the mountain behind them was up higher than everyone's head except for his.
Yeah.
His head has had a little smoothing around it. And then along, like you said, the edge of the cliff sides and the mountains, a little bit of feathering. You can tell it's CGI, but it looks really good, and it's great for the moment. And I was like watching it, I was like, man, I hope filmmakers I would like to see people play around with the sky more often because you can really digitally affect the look without making it feel fake because the sky and the clouds are so far away, it doesn't even feel like CGI if you manipulate it that much because it's so far from our characters and subjects. So I really like that moment. That's probably, besides The Mummy, my favorite moment of CGI in the film. And then I have a third favorite moment that looks really good, and that's Hamunaptra collapsing behind the three characters as they're escaping the city. That looks great. Especially, there's a huge stone brick wall that falls down into 1,000 pieces right behind the trio, and then the city completely falling into itself in the background. I really love that shot. Yes, you can tell it's CGI, but honestly, it looks really cool.
And speaking of Benny, we just got to shout out Kevin J. O'Connor.
Great.
Who's in some of your favorite movies of all time. I mean, he's great in The Mummy. Such a great character actor. He might be one of the more underrated actors out there. But he's also terrific in There Will Be Blood. He plays Henry, the guy conning Daniel into being his brother. He's such a terrific supporting actor in pretty much everything he does.
The Master,
Paul Thomas Anderson film. He's a supporting character in that as well. Terrific performance. But he's so good, and there's something about him. He can kind of do anything, it seems like. And this role of Benny is hysterical. Benny, we learn a lot about him. He's obviously sort of a guide for people. We learn from Rick that he sort of tricks people and abandons people in the desert after guiding them to locations and robbing them. He's morally a corrupt guy. He's a coward. He runs from conflict. And he just really will suck up to any power he can to survive. He'll do anything to survive. Unless his pride or his greed gets in the way, then that will be his downfall. Like, Benny could have survived with a boatload of ancient gold. However, because of his greed, he goes back into the tomb in Hamunaptra, where he eventually meets his demise. Inside, ironically, the biggest treasure on the planet, probably, by the Scarab Beetles in the darkness, completely alone. Because at the end of the third act of the movie, as everything's going down, and Benny accidentally sets off the tomb from collapsing, which is, you know, it's pretty comical that this little lever
in the middle of a hall
just destroy the entire city, but whatever, I'm here for it. It's a funny moment because he's exhausted from carrying all that gold. He could have gotten away. He had a bag of gold on the camel, which obviously
would have been rich enough.
At the end of the movie, it would have been super rich because it's ancient gold from Hamunaptra.
And we find out in the second film, they are very rich now.
They cashed in on that for sure. But Benny is just hysterical. He's really smart. He speaks several languages, which we find out when the mummy's about to kill him. He's praying to every single type of religion in different languages. And then he gets, obviously, to the Israeli language and with the Jewish Star of David. And then the mummy's like, oh, the language of the slaves, I can have some use of you. And he becomes the interpreter and sort of
facilitator,
second hand of the mummy going forward, of getting the men that have opened his box to complete the curse and to fully regenerate.
There's something about the character of Benny. It's really well written because they didn't make him just an evil guy. He's a bad guy, yes, but it's because he's fueled by cowardice and horrible fear of death. That's what drives him, and so it's not like he's always, and yes, he's greedy and stuff, but I think that him being constantly fueled by fear, and that's what drives him more than anything, kind of allows the audience to kind of empathize with him in a little bit, rather than him just being like twirling my mustache, I'm the bad guy of the movie, I'm gonna be the right hand man of the guy. He's choosing to serve the mummy out of fear, and so that kind of allows us to stay connected to him even when he's doing bad things, I think.
Yeah, I also really like the Americans in this movie. They're just like cliche cowboys, like
guns,
gunslingers,
playing poker. Ironically, this film was not shot in Egypt at all.
Was it? It's in Africa, in Sahara.
This was Sahara Desert. This was nearly entirely obviously shot in Morocco.
Yes, obviously Egypt's in Africa.
Yeah.
But I meant to say it's Saharan Desert.
So it was actually mostly shot in Morocco. There was a political turmoil and unrest in Egypt at the time of filming, so it wasn't safe to film there. And so this is one of the it's very popular to film in Morocco now. A lot of movies have been filming desert sequences in Morocco because it's become a great film production site in Northern Africa, where you can get these incredible Sahara Desert landscapes or whatever, and they've become a very efficient force there. This is one of the early major Hollywood productions to shoot entirely in Morocco. So everything was shot in that country, and then some of it was shot actually in the UK. So the Nile River was not shot in Africa at all. It was shot in England.
Mm.
It was a river in England they shot that entire sequence. So,
well, it's dark, so no one would know.
Yeah, exactly. No one can tell. So ironically, for being one of the most famous Egyptian movies, it was not shot in Egypt.
Very interesting. What I also love about this movie is it goes back to Evelyn being such a likable character, and her curiosity and inquisitiveness is just so endearing. And I love how she sort of sets forth the events of the mummy being risen by reading from the Book of the Dead.
You must not read from the book!
But because of her intelligence and being able to translate runes and ancient text, she's able to save the world after they get the Book of Amun-Ra, which is at the feet of Anubis, which they get later on, which they were searching for in the first place, the Book of Made of Gold, and is able to save the day while reading from that, even though Jonathan does a terrible job reading from it. It looks like a bird, like a stork.
So it's important. I mean, your character, if they can facilitate the conflict, it helps the story.
Yeah.
And so Evie actually does create the conflict.
It's just really funny, too, the way she does it. She's just curious, like, oh, it's just a book. No harm ever came from reading a book. And one of my favorite parts of the movie is several times they just play with the campiness of a curse pouring through a village, or like the characters, like wind comes and blows around. We hear like voices like every time they bring up a curse or anything like that or evil, it just happens. And it's just so funny.
Yeah. And so when we were kids, we loved ancient Egypt and learning about it in school. And I remember our dad, for I think a Christmas present, got us little canopic jars.
Well, we requested them.
Yeah, we requested them for our Christmas gift. And I remember, like, they were, like, the coolest thing. I had them on my bedside, like, canopic jars.
I love those canopic jars, man.
And so I think this movie helped fuel that love for the ancient culture of ancient Egypt, because it's a fascinating world, and it's a really interesting civilization, especially in the BC times. And because we know it as, you know, ruined monuments and an ancient city, but at the time, and it was really cool, what I like about the opening is we got a sense for, just like how ancient Rome, once it fell, it was stripped of many of its parts and minerals and beautiful architecture. Same thing happened with Egypt. Pyramids were stripped down. Most of the city was stripped down for materials and minerals. But it was an incredible, lush, highly efficient society, which is really fascinating.
There's a lot of great filmmaking in this movie as well. When it comes to camera work and just blocking and these sort of not very long shots, but maybe a 10-second shot where a lot of blocking is going on.
A lot fewer
cuts than we're used to today with Hollywood. Like really creative things, like when the character, the American whose eyes, his glasses have been broken, he's in the hallway by himself inside the tomb before he gets his eyes ripped out, but his glasses are broken and he can't see anything. And we're with the camera going left and right down the hallways, and they do this great whip pan where they're looking down the hallway, then we whip pan to the guy, and we whip pan to the right, and the mummy's right there after we see his figure down the hall. It's really great. Little things like that.
Also the shot in the alley, in the street alleyways.
Yeah.
Similar thing where the doctor who has the book, he's just trying to run away and he's hiding, and he turns a corner, and as he leaves frame, the mummy's behind him, tight close up. Really great.
So great little things like that. They're maybe 7-8 second shots, but they're complex, they're creative. Got lots of blocking going on, and I think just adds so much to the film, just little things like that, because I think sometimes people can take long takes a little too far and get a little too complicated with it, which is great when it's done well, but at the same time, you don't need to do a minute-long one-er for something really interesting. You can do it with a 10-second one-er or a 12-second one-er or 8-second one-er. You can do really cool things, and I think they do a great job with Summers behind the creative vision of this movie.
Saves time on shooting, too.
Yeah, it does, but I think it's really effective.
And speaking of the guy with no eyes and who gets his eyes ripped out and stuff, that's another example of, you know, off-screen gore. And we didn't see it happen, but, like, it's still, you feel it. You know what I mean? You can feel a sense of, like, this guy got his tongue ripped out and his eyeballs ripped out. It's wild. It's crazy. And so they did a great job with the off-screen horror in this film. It made you still felt what happened. You didn't see it, so they were able to skirt around that PG-13 rating really well, very successfully, in my opinion.
And we also have sort of a zombie rape movie in this movie for a little bit, for about 15 minutes, like a zombie film.
Emotep.
With obviously the brainwashing, or I don't know what that plague is, I can't remember.
The Boils,
and they just lose their minds, and they become followers of Emotep. But also, there's a great, I would call, Evil Dead shot, or Night of the Living Dead shot, where the mummy's hand just comes crashing through the dirt.
Yeah.
And just comes just gripping for
air.
Had
to get that.
Yeah, it's so terrific. I love that shot.
It's a great moment. And I really like, this is a good cat movie too.
It is a good cat movie.
The cat is like the thing that scares off the mummy multiple times. It's fantastic. And also, I really love the comedy. And I love Jonathan when he falls in with the Boyle crowd and he starts going, Emotep, Emotep. And then we get a great plane chase in the desert.
With Winston.
Yeah, Winston's so funny. He's like, you're probably not going to survive. Really? You think so?
He has some great jokes. What a great performance from this actor, too. Like when he's bumbling and drunk and just walks through the fountain twice. He says, oh, someone spilled their drink right there. And he's part of the Royal Navy, I mean the Royal Air Force in the city. And it's just one plane, the Royal Air Force Base. It's a really funny joke. But he's a hysterical character. I also really love Ardith in this movie. And once he's a member of the Magi, who are the secret protectors of Hamunaptra, and they've been, their whole purpose in life is devoted to making sure the beast is never risen, that the mummy never rises. Imhotep stays dead and buried and undiscovered. And he's the lead Magi of this group of warriors that are going after anyone who's coming into Hamunaptra a couple times. They could have done a better job of protecting. They could have just killed everybody. But it's a movie. You can't do that. But I think he's awesome in this movie. And I'm telling you, when we get Rick, we get Ardeth, and then we get Jonathan, the three of them together.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's like, it's fellowship vibes.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like Gimli, Aragorn, and Legolas running around just trying to find the hobbits. I get the same feel of that. Just these three guys just fucking stuff up. And the third act is bombastic. I mean, we have some great shots of all three of them just like firing guns on these mummies coming after them in this treasure room. Which is a great set. The treasure room is a terrific location. Really great production design. But it's so cool to have a shootout in there. Just like, bah, 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 bah. We have a machine gun. We have revolvers. We have shotguns. Even Jonathan's getting in on the action. But I just had a lot of fun when these three guys are together trying to save Evelyn.
There are a couple really great shootouts. I love the boat shootout with Rick
too.
Shooting all the bad guys. Well, not bad guys. We now learn they were trying to save the world. But shooting all the guys in the boat. There's fire everywhere. It's a really simple scene, but it's just like it hit all the right beats of an action scene. And then we were like, during that scene, we were both cheering, let's fucking go, this is awesome. No bullshit, it was just very simple filmmaking. It's just shooting with the comedy. When Evie saves him from the bullets and he jumps overboard and tells the other guy, wait, I'll come back for help. It's just a good time. It was just really fun. And then this action scene, the shootout in the gold room, so great. It's like it feels like a zombie movie. It's something that we've all come to love and seen a lot of nowadays. And I just love how we got so much just like unloading on the mummies. It was great.
And Arnold Vosloo is perfect as Imhotep in this film. He does a really great job. And he's an imposing force aesthetically. So I think he works so well as this villain. In the great third act, you know, the ritual gets interrupted again.
Again
by Rick O'Connell coming to save Evelyn. And while Jonathan's trying to read the Book of Amun-Ra, he sets the mummy's guards. After Anuxinamun, she gets slaughtered again. And fortunately, Evelyn's able to save
everyone,
and Rick from getting killed by the mummy, by Imhotep, by making him mortal from reading from the Book of Amun-Ra.
Another great long take is Rick fighting the first squad of mummies, mostly in one take. They did it in two takes. Of him doing that entire choreo, and it looks really fun.
It's awesome, choreo.
And he's fighting CGI.
It looks like he's either, maybe there's a few stunt people in suits, but it also looks like it was choreographed, like there's nothing there.
I don't think there's anyone with him. I think he did the whole choreo by himself, and then the animated characters after the fact.
Because they did a really good job. Whoever choreographed that scene is G. It looks so good.
It was really fun, just with two cuts. I mean, just one cut, two shots. It's just fantastic. I really loved it. And then I love when the badass soldiers show up with the curved swords and they can jump around. We saw more of them in the second film. They were in the first opening action scene, chasing them on the bus, remember?
Yeah.
I love that. And they're like crawling on the walls in the city and jumping off buildings and stuff. Like, that was a really sick action scene. I think audiences really love these mummies. And so they like double down on them in the second film for sure.
Yeah, and they do a great little tease of a potential sequel. When Imhotep dies, the last thing he says is death is only the beginning, which is what he said the last time he got killed.
Yeah.
So clearly, I'll be back.
I'll be back.
And
luckily, he only had to sleep for another like a year or so.
And we got, you know, a Hollywood ending, a happy ending. They ride off into the sunset. It's just like Raiders of Lost. It's just like Last Crusade. I love it. I love a golden Hollywood ending. Everyone gets what they want.
In the setting sun.
Yeah.
It's great.
And they don't realize they just became insanely rich off that ancient gold, even though Jonathan's upset. But the real treasure for Evelyn and Rick is they found each other.
I wouldn't say that. Yeah. It looks like we're going home empty-handed again. I wouldn't say that.
I love it, man. I love this movie.
And just the Hollywood kiss at the end in the sunlight.
It works.
Yeah, it's great.
I don't care what people complain about, all these goddamn film reporters and critics and crying about everything. It fucking works.
It's fucking awesome.
That's why we all love this movie.
I was dying for them to kiss in this movie.
So every men and women love this movie. Every part of it. We love the Hollywood ending. We love every component of this film.
It works. It's okay to end a movie feeling good. And it's okay to have some romance in a movie. It doesn't have to be every movie, but it's fun to have romance in a movie, especially a movie like this.
Yeah.
It's great.
Freaking love it. I also love the end credits. It's really beautiful, these great slow shots of panning down.
Oh, yeah.
Hieroglyphics.
Yeah, those are great.
With the cool designs of the actors and their hieroglyphics with the text. It's really beautiful. It's cool.
Really well done.
Man.
It's just a fun ending. So Imhotep's fall, Benny getting trapped in the tomb, and then them getting away scot-free, rich and in love. And it's a really good score as well. Alan Silvestri did it, I think.
I can't remember. No, it wasn't him.
No, someone. Whoever did it, they did a very good job. I like this.
They just unsubscribed.
Sorry. But Goldsmith, maybe. But it's just a really fun film. This is a perfect ending for the movie. This movie ended perfectly. Defeated the villain, fell in love, ended up rich. It's just, it hit all the beats that you want.
Jerry Goldsmith.
It was Goldsmith. Okay, music. Thank you.
That's great.
He did Alien.
Yeah, he did Alien, which I'm seeing on Sunday.
Fuck yeah, man.
Cannot wait.
Oh, man. And I really love this film. And honestly, I like it more than I ever did since I was a kid now.
I like it more every time I watch it.
It was just like, I was like, this is like the movies we loved growing up.
I feel like it was maybe one of my favorite movies when I was a kid.
Definitely, yeah. We watched it.
It was like maybe The Mummy wasn't my favorite movie. It was like this and Men in Black when I was like 9.
Because it's fucking good. It's just good, man. It's not the greatest movie ever. It's not a perfect film, but it's a really fun movie.
Speak for yourself. This is a perfect movie, Anthony. This is a perfect action-adventure film.
It's absolutely fantastic. I adore this movie.
Yeah, me too.
Hope maybe they'll make another one. We'll see.
I mean, Brendan is on fire right now, and Rachel is still a big star. I can see it happening. And John Hannah, I'm sure he'd come back for another one because he's just terrific as Jonathan. I think he's one of the best parts of the movie.
It was so funny seeing him in Last of Us opening.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, oh my God, it's fucking Jonathan from The Mummy. What?
I forgot about that. He's been in some stuff. Like, he was in an episode of Black Mirror recently.
Oh, good.
So he's still acting regularly, which is awesome.
That's good.
Lots of TV.
Sometimes not everyone makes it big.
Yeah, not everyone. There's a lot of
obviously,
competition
out there. Rachel had the best career of anyone in this film.
Brendan Fraser has an Oscar.
So does Rachel.
What did she win an Oscar for?
She won it for Johansson Gardner.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. 2005? Yeah, she's an Oscar winner.
I forgot about that.
It was like 20 years ago, bro. She won an Oscar a long time ago.
Well, I guess, yeah, you're right. Because she's in a lot of really, really good movies.
Yeah. She just had a fantastic career. Fantastic career.
Yeah, I'm not saying she hasn't. She's had an all-time career. She's a legend.
Legend.
I mean, The Favorite's terrific as well, and she's in so many good movies.
Oh my God, everyone loves her. Everyone loves Rachel Weisz.
Everyone loves Rachel Weisz.
She can do anything.
She's even in, except for The Bourne Legacy.
Yeah, but
not her fault.
Yeah, it's not her fault.
Not her fault.
It was a good. You got to sign on to that if you're an actor. You're like, $5 million, okay. Big, huge spy movie. Yeah, it's big.
You got anything else on The Mummy?
I got some fun facts.
Oh, I'd love to hear these.
Okay, these are good.
Waiting for Anthony to pull up his fun facts.
Okay. And this is a funny gag. So in one scene, Benny is shown with a sack full of gold, and he's trying to load it onto a camel. This is during the third act. And he pulls out one of the camel's ropes, and it won't come and walk with him. This actually was because they threw this in the film because in real life, none of the camels on set liked Kevin O'Connor, and they would never move for him. So they threw it into the movie as a joke.
It's really funny.
And then the Magi were originally supposed to be tattooed completely from head to toe. But Steven Sommers vetoed it because he thought Oded Fehr, who played
Ardeth,
was too good-looking to be covered up.
It's a good-looking man.
Deuce Bigelow.
It's a good-looking man.
He's the gigolo.
That's right. The real gigolo.
Yeah, he's the real gigolo. The white nightgown Evelyn wore when the ship was attacked became transparent when she got soaking wet. So they actually, in post, had to CGI and cover up her private areas.
I bet the visual effects editor was working on that for a month.
Sorry, I'm still... I'm going to need like at least 3 more months on this, guys. The production had the complete support of the Moroccan army, and the cast members had kidnapping insurance taken out on them. A fact that Steven Sommers, the director, did not disclose to them until after shooting the film because he didn't want to scare them.
That's pretty funny. That's how you do it, man.
Morocco's very safe to shoot now. It's very safe to shoot there.
Is that all you got?
That's all I got. It's great. Great stuff.
Well, thank you so much for everyone tuning in to our episode on The Mummy. It was so fun to revisit this film and talk about it in depth on the show because we know you all love it as much as we do. We hope you learned something new from it.
Oh, yeah.
Or got a new appreciation for it and revisit it and have just a great time checking it out. If you saw it in theaters and it's re-released this past weekend, and it's probably still in theaters for a few more days, which we're so excited about. Also, Alien has a re-release this past weekend, so check out Alien if you can.
Classics, man.
I mean, I feel like the studios listen to Raiders of the Lost podcast because they're all just releasing movies. I just heard Lord of the Rings trilogy is getting re-released on June 8th in theaters.
4K.
4K
restorations.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So
let's go.
Yeah, man. It's great. And I do think that The Mummy in 50 years, people will still adore this film.
Yeah.
It's going to be one of those films that just like everyone who grew up watching it will be old and will be like, oh, let's watch The Mummy.
That's what I was thinking about last time. Classic. Like, this movie's so timeless that in 50 years, I'll be like, fuck yeah,
The Mummy.
Better get it on physical.
We'll be watching it in VR. We'll be in the film.
I will be Rick O'Connell. All right. Thank you so much for tuning in. Become a patron today at patreon.com/Raiders of the Lost Podcast. Leave those 5-star ratings and reviews and take care.
See you next time.
This episode was executive produced by our chosen one patrons, Cody Moen, Andrew Hagen, Becca Keen, Benjamin Cook, Calvin Murphy Griggs, Nicholas Martin, Darian Singleton, Tyler McFly, Andrew Hagen. Our chosen one patrons are our biggest supporters. Thank you so much. Raiders of the Lost Podcast is a Mirror Image production. Sound mixing done by Jacob Kosler. Opening music by Chase Jackson.